This is Barry Tyler of the UW Oral History Project. Today is March 7th, 1990.
1990.
I'm in my office with V. Kyle Binder, who just graduated a couple of months ago from the university, and we're going to talk about his years here as an undergraduate. Why don't you start off by telling us, first of all, where are you from?
I'm from Grafton, which is near Milwaukee. I moved there when I was 12. Originally, I was born in Port Washington, then moved to Cedarburg when I was very young, and then when I was 12, moved over to Grafton. But Cedarburg and Grafton are the twin cities of Ozaukee County, so it wasn't that big of a move.
You went to the public schools in
Cedarburg and Grafton.
What made you decide to come to UW?
Well, it's sort of a familial thing. All three of the... Oh, can we stop? Jeez. Starting that over. My dad and his two brothers went here, and three of my mom's brothers also went here. So it was almost, I don't want to say expected of me to come here, but it kind of seemed that way. And basically, ever since I was a small child, I was entranced by the stories that my dad's younger brother would tell. He was here in the 60s when everything was really dynamic, and I thought, wow, this would really be a great place for me to go. And I ended up here. I went to Bradley, which is in Peoria, Illinois. It's a nice place, kind of small, a little dull, and it really didn't fit in with what I wanted to do, so I came here.
Now, with all that background for UW, what made you, was it your choice to go to Bradley?
Somewhat. It was more of an economic choice than anything. I got a scholarship. Not a full scholarship, but enough that it made it very affordable to go there.
What kind of scholarship was it?
Just, it was called the Bradley Special Scholarship, and they just give it out to deserving kids like myself. Okay. That I didn't really ask for it. I just applied for a financial aid like I did everywhere else I applied to go to school and got it in the mail one day. You've been awarded the Bradley Special Scholarship. Oh, so, looks like that's where I'm going, yeah.
So, and how long did you last there?
I went there for a year.
For a year, and then you transferred right to UW.
Mm-hmm.
What year are we talking about?
I went to Bradley in 85, 86.
You started here or not?
In August of 86. Yeah. Seems like...
Well,
I knew in October of my year at Bradley that it wasn't going to fulfill my needs. You know, professionally and academically. I mean, there's some good people there, people that I can still consider my very good friends that I stay in touch with. But it just didn't hack it as a college for me.
Were you starting to get some indication at that point in your freshman year, even of where you were headed in college, what you wanted out of college?
Yeah, I know I wanted more than what Bradley had to offer. I mean, Bradley had some terrific qualities. The small classes are something I certainly miss. I mean, here I was a freshman in a class with just 14 other freshmen and really good faculty. But beyond that, socially is kind of a dud. I mean, unless you wanted to join a fraternity there, there's nothing for you to do until you turn 21.
So there wasn't any real campus life per se?
No, not on campus.
How did that compare with UW when you arrived here in August of 86?
I was almost bowled over by how much there is to do here. I went to the, my first roommate took me to the Union. I was just amazed. And this is on campus. And Bradley's Union isn't even a union. It's called a student center. It's a small building right in the middle of campus. There are things to do there, but the best thing to do is a bowling alley. And they took that out. So I come to the Union and I said, oh my God, look at all the people. And they're all enjoying themselves. And my roommate said, well, get used to it. It happens. There's always something going on campus. He talked like that.
How did you meet your roommate? Where did you live?
I met him when I moved in.
Did you move into a dorm?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
I lived in Whitty, 10th floor, room 1033. Okay. Young house, yes.
How long did you live in dorms?
I lived a year in the dorms at Bradley and a year in the dorms here.
Compare the dorms at Bradley to the dorms at UW.
The big difference is that Whitty is co-ed. And the freshmen at Bradley really don't live in co-ed dorms. It's neat. living right down the hall from a bunch of women. I liked it. I liked it a lot. It's not as rowdy. Of course, there is rowdiness going on, but having the women there is really a plus for me.
So it was a plus in terms of not only because there were women socially, but also because it put a check on the behavior of a little, yeah.
For some reason, it just seemed to... What's the word? It's like having a... Oh, never mind.
It's like, okay, what about food? How does food occur?
Well, at Bradley, you just went in and showed your ticket and said, okay, go on, and you can eat as much as you want, you know, basically free, which was neat. Here at the university here, of course, you have your meal tickets, and you end up paying, essentially, for your food. As far as quality goes, I'd say Bradley had a slight edge. That doesn't really matter. Dorm food is dorm food no matter where you go.
So it wasn't great stuff.
No, I got you through. Got you through.
Well, with the co-ed dorm, I've never lived in a dorm, so I'm curious about this. Did you socialize with a lot of women because of the dorm? Were there a lot of co-ed activities structured within the life of the dorm itself?
Definitely. Dances and picnics and barbecues and so forth.
Was there a sense of identity that began to emerge in Woody in your time there?
Of the dorm or the just
the
floor? Not so much in the dorm, the entire dorm, but in the each individual floor had its identity.
What was your identity?
We were just the people on top. They were in the penthouse, the 10th floor, and you live with the same people long enough, and either you get completely sick of them or you develop a very strong bond, and that's what happened in our case. Everyone knows everyone. Everyone likes everyone. And there are little petty differences, of course, between people, which is impossible to avoid. But on the whole, everyone got along swimmingly.
What were the identities of some of the other floors?
We had mostly a floor of sophomores. It's predominantly sophomores. And that makes a tremendous amount of difference in the dorms. Some other floors were mostly freshmen from... Oh, this is going to sound disparaging. But there's a lot of freshmen from up north that were just rowdy, you know, would destroy things and set off the fire alarms and things like that. We had mostly sophomores from around Milwaukee, which was another bonding element.
Okay. And was so, that an intentional thing that they did?
I stopped trying to figure out the housing a long time ago.
You were going to say something else?
Oh, no. Just that housing would... put people together seemingly at their whim. Two people at the end of the hall, Scott and Scott. Rick and Rick. That's just the way they work. There's really no rational basis for it at all.
Could you tell, was there a big difference between being a freshman and being a sophomore in the dorm? Could you tell the difference in behavior?
Yeah, freshmen seemed, especially here, it's so big. They just seemed overwhelmed for a while. And it takes a while to get that somewhat famous UW cynicism, where nothing really seems to rattle your cage anymore. And when you're a sophomore, you know where everything is, and you know what to expect out of school, you know what to expect out of the faculty, you know what to expect out of the food, things like that. When you get here, it's all new. But by the second semester, I think that's when everything really fell into place for both me and the entire floor. I mean, there's always that feeling out process, but... Fortunately for me, there was always something going on that I could partake in.
Did this relationship with the 10th floor, with your colleagues there, did that carry over in incidental ways throughout your undergraduate days?
How do you mean?
I mean, did you keep in contact with any of these people, bump into them on campus, things like that?
During the year I lived in the dorms or after?
Afterwards.
Oh, definitely. Some of my best friends are people I met in the dorms.
Was there any rivalry between, like, Witty and Celery or anything like AUG or any of those kinds of things?
I suppose. And that silly little chant trading that they would do.
What?
They'd trade chants. People in AUG would get in and yell at Witty B, you know, Witty sucks. Yeah. AUG sucks. Witty sucks.
From the windows?
Yeah.
Oh.
And there was a little bit of a rivalry, and not that much. I think the biggest manifestation I could think of was a snowball fight that I remember very well. First day it snowed a lot, in December of 86, big snowball fight. Everyone went out. And of course, all the Wittians were fighting amongst themselves until some people from Og foolishly came down Dayton Street to try to join in the fray. And there's nothing like a common foe to unite disparate peoples. And they really got pummeled and they had to flee in terror back to their dorms.
They didn't come back with reinforcements?
No, they didn't.
Where did you live after that?
Well, I moved back home for the summer and then came back and lived on North Carroll Street.
Why did you leave the dorms?
You know, that's a funny thing. I think it's almost expected of juniors to be out of the dorms. It seems like when I know now, having been removed from the dorms for a while, when I think of dorms, I think of freshmen and sophomores. So it just seemed almost expected. And I figured it was about time. I was 20, 21, essentially. I figured it's about time I learned how to keep a house.
So you were ready, too?
Oh, yeah, I was ready to get out of the dorms.
And most of your friends who were sophomores went out on their own?
Almost all.
Who did you live with in your junior year?
Someone I knew from my hometown.
Oh, from home, not from your
home. No. He went to school here, and I
where was this guy? Where did you live?
Grafton.
No, I mean...
I lived on North Carroll Street.
North Carroll Street.
It was beat-up brown apartment building. That wasn't all that great, but it was home.
Did you like it more than dorms, less than dorms? How do you compare?
There's a lot more freedom outside of the dorms. And if you have your own room when you live off campus, then you don't always have to be dealing with a roommate in a small cubicle. And you know, if you want to come home late at night, if you have your own room, you can just go into your own room. You won't disturb anybody. I mean, that's happened to me. I've done that to my roommates. Just a lot more personal freedom.
Now, let's turn to your classes for a few minutes. Okay. When you came here, were there any classes that that you were determined to take, or were there any classes that you took that really helped shape your direction in your undergraduate education?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to go into broadcasting. And to get into that, you have to take the broadcasting track of the journalism program. There's broadcasting, news editorial, which is for print. There's advertising if you're going into PR. And so I knew basically the classes I'd have to take. And of course, what I didn't know is whether or not I'd like them. And at first it was a little shaky taking the preliminary courses, learning news writing and reporting. When I finally got to my radio class when I was a junior, I think it was. When I was a junior, I knew right then and there that that was the right choice. I had a great teacher. And teachers, my professor was Tom Grimes, who I think is a wonderful teacher. And my TA was Perry Irwin, who's right now working for the Wisconsin Public Radio Bureau in Stevens Point. Just really fun people who knew the business and could teach it well. And that really helped me make my decision.
So how big was that class that
you
were taking?
There's a big class of about 70 people, and then we knocked it down into five groups each day.
What did they do that got you so excited about, or helped you make the decision that this was what you wanted?
They really seemed to enjoy what they were doing, which is something I put a lot of weight behind. Tom would be up there giving his lecture, and he'd just really be into it. And he has a slight southern drawl, which made him really interesting to listen to. And Perry is really funny, so that helps too. Because there's a lot of pressure in radio.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can alleviate it, it makes it a lot more enjoyable.
Now, with a major like that as an undergraduate, you mentioned the word pressure. Is there a lot of that in that program, and how do you deal with it?
You mean academically?
Well, I mean in terms of, do you feel like you're being judged all the time? Because as a broadcast student, I could see how you might feel like every time you open your mouth, you're essentially being judged, or is that not true?
I never felt that way. I just tried to do my best and be happy with that. Fortunately, I seem to have some sort of talent for this. It may sound arrogant, but I did well. I think I got an A, B, or an A in radio. I just did my best, handed it in, and we'd do our little broadcast and feed it to WLHA, that 1-watt powerhouse down on the lakeshore. And I'd just be happy with that.
What happened with it after you fed it to the one watt?
Well, did it just kind of get the people who could pick it up would listen to it. I knock on wood. It's just a one watt station. It was a good experience because you were actually putting on a broadcast that went over the air.
How far does one watt broadcast?
Well, sometimes you can pick it up in this building here in the Armory, if I think if the wind is right. When I used to live on Carroll Street, I was on the third floor of this building. And so if I put my radio in the right spot of the house with the antenna at a certain angle, I could pick up WLHA, which is a shame. I think a university of this stature and size and wealth should have a big campus radio station that's been a controversy for years. And then they still haven't had one. I would have killed to work. Well, not killed, for goodness sake. I would have been great if I could have worked in a big, when they're talking like a 50,000 watt station here. That'd be fantastic. The experience would be just amazing.
Why don't they have one?
Politics. And that's in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Is your opinion shared by other people in your field?
For the most part, I think. It's mostly born out of frustration. It's been on the drawing board for, I think, the entire time I've been here. Maybe even before that. And nothing's really happened. So like, you can't get a license if you don't have a lawyer. And by state law, the committee trying to get a station can't have a lawyer, and the governor could do something but isn't and doesn't want to, and it's just a joke. So if you're listening, give us a station.
You said that you had always known you wanted to go on broadcast. Mm-hmm. When did I know?
When I was four years old.
Talking to a microphone?
I grew up very near to my mother's rather large family. My mother was the second oldest of 11 children. And I was born when she was still relatively young. And she had all these brothers and sisters that were just, and of course, being young, they're out doing things. And in a big yard like we had, they'd always play sports and play football. And they'd always, which is fairly common, they'd play by play their own games. Mm-hmm. And being 3 years old, just absorbing things, I picked it up. And finally, one Sunday, when I was about four, with my uncle who was six and two of my other uncles who were in their teens. I mean, they were the Bears and we were the Packers, and they let us win, and they were, what an incredible play. This little kid, he's only 4 years old, but what talent. Well, thank you. It's just great to be here. Hi, Mom. And I was entranced.
So that was your introduction to
a backyard football game at the age of four. Yeah.
Getting back to college now.
Okay.
You had Tom Grimes, is that his name? Mm-hmm. Was your teacher? Well, you continue in your education. Were there any other classes or professors that you feel were had an influence on you in one way or the other?
I had Professor William Hecton for two classes, and that really taught me how to see and recognize problems and how to write effectively about them. Global issues. I did a class that we basically discussed the issues of the time, and our assignments were to write editorials, and that showed me how to write an objective, if that thing, such a thing is possible, an objective editorial. And I took a class on the Third World and the media's role in that, and that really opened up my eyes to a few things.
So you had a pretty heavy dose of journalism as well as broadcasting.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Was it kind of like 50-50, or how did that break out?
I think it's slanted more towards, I don't think journalism and broadcasting are self-exclusive, like the tone of that, the sentence you said. I think it all works together. If I had to say, if I had one more than the other, I'd say it's more of a print leaning than to broadcast, because it's probably cheaper to do that. In my television class, for example, we had this, our equipment was really beat up secondhand, and it takes so long to get new equipment that you just have to deal with the old stuff. It's cheaper to sit down at a typewriter and type something on a piece of paper than it is to take out these $2,000 television cameras. So probably more for economic reasons than anything else was slanted towards the print, mm-hmm. which is fine. That's a mm-hmm. great foundation to start with. If you can't write, right, you can't do anything in broadcasting.
When you applied for, did you apply for school?
Journalism? Yeah, I did.
What were the requirements, do you remember?
Oh, gosh. I think You had to have an overall 2.5 or 2.6 and pass the journalism usage test, which I had no trouble with, and my grades were high enough. I basically got in, you know, as I applied. I think you had to be a junior, too.
This is an unfair question. I have no idea if you can answer it, but can you characterize the kind of people who are in journalism and broadcasting?
Yeah, I'll try. You have to be persistent. You have to be nosy. You have to be willing to work hard. And just a certain, and you have to be able to write well. It helps to be articulate, I guess.
Okay.
And it's very hard to pin everybody down, because within all those classifications, there are just so many different people and so many different styles.
Now, we've talked about writing a little bit, and you pointed out that you really can't separate the writing from the broadcast, because they're both, weave them both.
Mm-hmm.
You did do some writing. Didn't you have a job, Badger Herald?
Yeah, I wrote for the Herald.
Let's talk about the writing experiences you had at UW, if you had any others besides Badger Herald, or just get into Badger Herald.
Well, I started at Bradley, writing for the Bradley Scout, which was this little weekly paper that was put out. It was all right. It was a good experience. And as a freshman, they basically took me and threw me into the breach, which was great. Up here,
what did you write on?
I wrote sports.
Sports. And was it like games or editorials?
Yeah, little spot news too, but that was really just inconsequential. I never got to my spot news bylined.
So did you follow like the wrestling
team? I basically did the women's sports, volleyball and softball. Softball was pretty big because they had a really hot pitcher, Beth Hawkins. No relation to Hersey Hawkins. Mm-hmm. Basketball star, but that was the big beat, and they were ranked, and she was good. Although, looking back, my writing is nowhere near as good as it is now, which is inevitable because you're always improving. And for one thing, I never had any formal training. When I got to Bradley, I didn't really take a journalism class until the second semester, and that was just mass communication, one of those sweeping survey classes.
Did they have journalism courses?
Oh, they did. They just...
You just never got to them?
No.
What about up here then, did you write?
Up here, I went to the Herald's organizational meeting the fall of my sophomore year, and then proceeded to get somewhat overwhelmed, a word that keeps coming up, by the size of the campus. And it took me a while to get my feet back. And once I did, I was really more prepared to do some writing. Now, back when I was a sophomore, I think it was a more senior-dominated paper. I mean, the seniors wrote better, and so that was fine with me if they would do more of the writing and turn out a better product. But finally, by the spring, they called and said, you'd like to do more writing? I said, yeah, I would. And they said, well, why don't you just go across the street to the surf and do a story on the women's swimming team? And there I went, and there it was. My first story, first big story in the Herald, was on the four NCAA swimming meet qualifiers.
And that was when?
That was in March of 87.
What kind of reporting did you do after that?
Mostly features, because that's what I seem to do best. I did event coverage, I think track meets, things of that nature, but I did mostly features. The funnest one I did was on two high jumpers. I can't remember their names. Smithback and Bear, I think their names were. They were really, really funny. And it was a good story because you can't miss with good material.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave it to me in spades. And it's just a great article, and I have it to this day. It'll be great for the clipping sheet as I go pursue a job.
Yeah. What about jobs? Let's talk about that before we go back to some of this other stuff. You've graduated now.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of markets are you looking at? What kind of jobs are you looking for specifically?
I'd like to go into television reporting, preferably sports. Starting out, you'd have to really look at markets under 100 or lower in this area. Markets like
what that means.
Market size. The rankings by size. New York would be the first, I think. Chicago second, Los Angeles third, down the line. Milwaukee's 30, Madison's 88, and some place like Wausau would be 135, and Eau Claire La Crosse would be 140, Peoria would be 105, Rockford is 110, something like that. It's basically self-starting. You have to go.
It's like training.
Yeah, in a sense. It's almost like a farm system for the bigger stations. Yeah. If you can do the job, they'll call you up.
Seems to me, I remember seeing that a lot of Madison's announcers are from Wausau, places like that.
Yeah.
They start out in these days.
Yeah. I would like to stay in the Midwest, and I probably will.
You think the chance? What do you think your chances are of getting a job in the
Midwest?
Yeah.
Well, I'm pretty cocky. I think I'll get a job. I have the goods. I know I can do that. I know I can do it. All I need is a chance.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
How do you go about presenting yourself? Do you do some kind of tape?
Well, at first you mail a resume and a cover letter to a station you're interested in. And if they like it, they'll probably call you back and ask you to send out a tape. And that's what I'm going to do very soon, is have a tape made of what shows what you can do, what sort of stories you can write, how you look on camera, things of that nature.
What about some of the other areas that you've had experience in and worked in, like reporting and radio announcing, things like that? Are those viable alternatives also?
I don't have as much faith in my writing ability in print as I do in broadcasting. I'm not going to exclude getting a radio job. That would be foolish because there's so much more opportunity there. I'd prefer television, but print reporting definitely helps. It helps you know how to collect the facts, sort the facts, and write the story.
So your degree was in
journalism.
Journalism/slash broadcasting journalism.
I don't know how they classify it. I think it's in journalism. I don't know if you would call it broadcast journalism. I suppose you would, since I graduated from the broadcast track. I don't know how I haven't gotten my diploma yet.
Regarding the rest of your schooling, you obviously have a lot of courses, basic courses, and L&S and whatnot, full requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on that? Do you think you had a pretty broad liberal arts education? And if so, could you talk about some of the courses that you took that you found particularly compelling?
Well, I don't really consider myself to be very gifted in math and science, so I just took the minimums there. And when I found out that food science counted for a science credit, I jumped all over that because Professor Ken Lee gives you so much interesting information entertainingly. It was astounding, and I really enjoyed it. I have more of a yen for history and that sort, and so I took a lot of history classes. I enjoy history. Great teachers. And considering I liked it so much, I can't really give an objective judgment. I mean, they did a great job.
Who were some of the teachers you liked?
The most, I guess, would be, I think his first name is John, Professor Cooper. I think he might actually be head of the history department.
Yes, he is.
Is it John Cooper?
Yeah.
And he taught my U.S. history 1914 to 45 class. Really was on the ball. And he was funny, too. So was, I think, William Kaufman, who taught my military history class last fall. Funny guy.
We're going to go to a different area of your undergraduate education now, one that you might not be so anxious to talk about. Your leisure time. Now, we're making this tape for posterity.
I know, there's a certain amount of pressure on me to be witty, charming, and articulate.
75 years from now, who knows what this world's going to be like and what people are going to be doing.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about some of the different areas that you've seen and you've been involved with over your time here. Starting out with music, what kind of music do students listen to?
Students listen to everything. The one music I really don't hear that much of is country music around here. I mean, that's just not a really student-y type music, as near as I can tell. But I guess alternative music is what you'd find most of all, and especially as you get older here. When you're a freshman or a sophomore, a lot of people are still listening to a lot of heavy metal and top 40, which seems to me to be more of a high school taste. I had my heavy metal and top 40 phases back when I was a freshman and sophomore in high school. So then I got more into the quote-unquote alternative music sort of bang.
Yeah, I'm going to make you define this a little more. Let's talk about heavy metal for a second.
Heavy metal.
What is that, and who are some of the groups that represent heavy metal?
Heavy metal is loud, very loud, guitar-dominated rock and roll, I suppose. some of the groups.
Yeah. Oh, and you geez. Listened to when you were
when I was when I was in high school. Well, I could just update a little bit. I mean, there's Guns N' Roses. There's Motley Crue. There is AC/DC, the Perennials. AC/DC. They've been around forever.
Does that mean Tony Mandarich is stuck in a junior high phase with this?
Tony Mandarich is big enough that he can be stuck wherever he wants to be.
For those of you who's been 100 years tackling for football, Green Bay Packers.
Maybe he will be a legend by then. Yeah, people go, Mandarich? Yeah, hell of a player.
You may never start either. Now, alternative music.
Alternative music, that's more my bag.
What do you mean by that, and who are some of the people we're talking about?
There are the, I guess, the classic alternative groups that came out in the early 80s, and even a little bit earlier than that, like The Clash, R.E.M., B-52s, who right now are enjoying a renaissance, U2 used to be, I guess, what you call alternative. Now they're just so massively popular, I don't know if you can call them that anymore. I used to be a really big U2 fan, and then as they got so big, I just sort of shied away. That's my personal taste. I don't really like it, which is too bad. I mean, I like them, not as much as I used to, just because everyone else likes them.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're being contrary.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, just like you're not liking something simply because everyone else does.
Well, their Joshua Tree album came out when I was still in the dorms. And this was at a time when a lot of people knew who U2 was, but they weren't really that sure. And then all of a sudden, this album comes out, and it seemed like all 72 people on that floor were listening to the Joshua Tree. I mean, I can't hear a song off that album without flashing back mm-hmm. to something that was going on in the dorms at that time.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite group?
My
now?
Favorite group is XTC.
And that's a alternative?
Yeah, I suppose you'd call them alternative. They make very catchy songs. They just can't sell records.
Is it has guitars and drums and yeah. pretty much. So
yeah,
kind of
there
rap
are different genres within alternative. I guess around here, rap would still be considered alternative mm-hmm. because, well, that's just the town Madison is. It's not New York with its large urban black population. And there are kids that listen to rap, and there are people that don't go here that listen to rap. And, you know, there are younger high school students, you know, not on campus, of course, that listen to rap.
What about jazz?
Jazz is... It's always there. It's not really my style of music. I think my music fits my personality, which is, and the job I'm looking for, which is you have to have a lot of creativity within very strict guidelines. Not very strict, but going into television, you can't just be way out wacko.
Robin Williams.
Yeah. I mean, I that wouldn't work in television news. And that's just the way I am, too. I like some jazz, and probably when I get older, I'll like it more. But it seems like as you get older, you like jazz. Right now, I'm still exploring this alternative scene.
What about alcohol? How prominent was that at Peoria, in the dorms, here in the dorms, and in your own?
Very predominant, which is not a knock. I mean, if you know what you're doing, it's fun. It's all get out.
I'm not making judgments.
In Peoria, the scene was that the people I hung out with in Wyckoff Hall, we're not in frats. We didn't want to be in frats. We didn't really care about the frats. So we just kept to ourselves and went to one room where they took one of the beds. They had beds with shelves built in, turned it on its side under the loft they built, and made it into a bar, Ron and Dick's Bar, and spent a lot of time there drinking. There's nothing else to do in Peoria. Bradley is a pretty easy university compared to here. I really had to bust my hump here. At Bradley, I had to work hard, sure, but I coasted. Mm-hmm. In the second semester, I had a hell of a time. It was party, party, party. I mean, I'd go out and do things and drink just about 5 nights a week, and I still got a 3-4.
Now, when you say drink 5 nights a week, let's say it's...
Not drink to get really hammered.
All right, but let's just say it's Wednesday night and you've done your work. What are you going to, how much are you going to drink, and what kind of stuff are you
couple doing? Beers, maybe. Just go down and just shoot the breeze with the guys.
So we're not talking about a dozen of pitchers or anything like that.
No, that was on the weekends. No, no, no. Honestly, we were teetotalers. On the wagon the first day I got there. So no, we're just to go down and have a couple beers and talk sports or something like that. Or what exam do you got coming up? Oh, this. You need any help? Yeah, I'm a little bit fuzzy on this. Things just... Very
so
casual.
Now you come to Madison, which of course we know is known for its being a dry city.
Oh, definitely.
So, well, how did
it's like living in here? Salt Lake City. No, how is it here?
Yeah.
The temptations, the dorms. It depends on the nature. We had a very well-behaved floor. So our house fellow, bless her heart, knew that we were responsible young men and women. And as long as we didn't do anything really stupid, it was cool. I mean, you couldn't bring half barrels or anything like that into the dorms officially. But you could drink in your dorms if you were 21 and over. I was. Most of my friends were. And, you know, sometimes it didn't drink as much. Usually people would save it for the weekends because it's a lot harder of a school. But every so often you get done studying and just go out for a couple beers or just sit in your room and have a couple of beers.
Were you asked by people under 21 to buy the beers, things like that?
Yes.
Did you do it?
No comment.
Okay.
Not going to pin me down on that one.
I forgot. I neglected to ask you when we were talking about dorms. Tell me about your house girl.
She was a sweetheart. I would like to keep in touch with her, except I fear that she's moved from the address I used to have. She saw that we were responsible, and she really respected that. And she knew that we were basically self-governing. I don't know if that's the right phrase to use. And so she let us just...
She
stayed out of our hair.
But you knew that she was there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if there was a problem or anything, or something got out of hand... And Jane would be the first person we'd go see.
So it was a really good thing.
Oh, it was very good, yeah. I would not have wanted to be corralled, shall we say, by a house fellow being a sophomore, having a year under my belt and all that. Being 20, which was, I was grandfathered after the drinking age went up, so I was fine. Most of my friends were fine, too, so.
Did she, did this come about the fact that you had this mutual respect? Did this come about because of any active thing on her part, or was it just sort of the luck of the draw?
I think we just got a good house fellow. The house fellow that was on the floor the year before that was really hyper. And she'd be all over the place and writing everybody up for various and sundry violations of the housing codes. And some things that were really petty, she would grandstand into a major issue. Then the year I came in, we got Jane Peterson, and she was, you know, like I said, she knew what to expect of us.
So she gave more.
Yeah. Some of the people who were there the year before sat down and talked with Jane. Like, I guess you could call them the house leaders. Mm-hmm. Said, look, Jane, I mean, there's going to be some problems, but really don't worry. We can take care of ourselves. You know, we'll don't worry about us. We should be fine. And after a while, we proved it. It didn't take long, maybe a couple months. And there's always something coming along, like someone playing music really loud or getting obnoxiously drunk and performing petty vandalism. But it was nothing that she couldn't handle, nothing that we couldn't handle. Like, there's always those dorm pranks, like someone taking silly string, someone I consider my best friend, took silly string, went down the hall and, you know, tied everybody's doors together. It was very pretty to see, actually. Well, you know, the silly string, then. It's this aerosol spray that comes out, and it's in the form of a long string. And she just went down and went around doorknobs, went down and just sprayed it along the wall, ran around and did another doorknob, sprayed around, just looping the silly string.
And what was the effect?
It just looked nice, because it's this aerosol spray with not much. And once it dries, it has the consistency of, of a sandcastle, wet sand. You just open the door and it breaks. Oh, there it was. Who put silly string on our doors? Later we found out who it was. It was nothing really that major of a violation, if it was at all. I considered it more funny than anything else.
Now you're a junior at Carroll Street. What about the alcohol in those situations?
Well, when the higher up the academic ladder you go, the harder you have to work. And there wasn't that much just sitting around after you finish studying, sitting around and relaxing after that, because usually you study right up to bedtime and then go to bed. Or so, I was seeing someone at the time too, so I was study right up until that's over and then I'll spend time with her.
Okay, so there wasn't that compulsion during 5 nights a week?
Oh, sometimes I wanted to, but no. No.
What about
Mostly on the weekends.
drugs? What did you see of those in your dorms? First, starting with Bradley and moving up to Whitty, and then what drug? I know that drug use is, is there. But what kind of drugs were people using, and how frequently were they using?
At Bradley in my dorm floor, I didn't see any of it. It was a pretty straight-laced floor. And they all went off to their fraternity houses for fun. I don't know what they did there besides drink themselves silly, which is a fairly common activity when you're 18 years old. When I there was a cocaine bust in the dormitory next to ours, which was a huge scandal. Ooh, this guy got busted for cocaine. Ooh, in Peoria. But there was really no drug use that I could see. Up here, I saw a lot more marijuana. Nothing really beyond that. Marijuana is pretty much still the illegal drug of choice.
What about when you were living with Pearl Street? Pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So cocaine is not really a common student type of drug.
No, it's kind of expensive.
What about things like angel dust and things like
No,
that?
nothing really hard. I think hallucinogenic mushrooms is about as hard as I ever saw. I've heard of people doing cocaine occasionally, very, very rarely. Like once every 2 years, just at a party, someone will have some and they'll do
That's interesting. I would have thought it might be a little more frequent than that.
it. Marijuana, it just seems to be the drug of choice.
Do people even consider it illegal anymore?
That's very interesting. I don't know. At first, no. I had to say, people, especially with the Harvest Fest. People just considered it a great fun to go up to the Harvest Fest and smoke in the Capitol Square. I don't really see any harm in it, being the liberal sort that I am.
What about dealers? Were there any problems? Was that a, or did
With
students buy from other students? Is that it?
that's essentially it.
So you didn't have any hard drug dealers
Any
coming into your
swarthy
dorms?
illegal types walking the grounds? No, students buy
What
from
was
students.
the student attitude towards police, things like that?
Actually, everyone sort of liked the Madison police, but the on-campus police and security met with a certain amount of scorn. It seemed like they were just trying too hard to do their job. A lot of petty things they would fly off the handle about. There's some things they had to break up, of course, but people, for example, passed out in the den, which was pretty frequent on Saturday, on Fridays and Saturdays. And PNS would come up, and everyone's staying up trying to detox before they go to bed so they're not hungover. Someone's snoring rather loudly. Hey, wake this guy up and get him to bed, or I'll bring him to detox. Why? He lives here. He's just asleep. Well, you better get him to bed pretty soon, otherwise I'm going to call an ambulance. Fine, go ahead. We'll put him to bed. Things like that.
So there was definitely a feeling that the Madison police were okay.
Yeah.
These guys were a little
Gung-ho.
gung-ho.
Yeah.
The last area, I'm not going to go into detail on, for obvious reasons, but I want to talk a little bit about sexual attitudes on campus. You've lived through an incredibly unique and in many ways distressing time from that point of
Oh,
view.
it's scary.
We're talking, of course, about AIDS. How deep, I'm asking you about how it affected you and people you know, friends and acquaintances and whatnot. How has the AIDS epidemic, how has it affected you and your attitudes to it?
Well, I've always been the type of person that is, outside of a relationship, I have a lot of trouble with just like a tawdry one-night stand or something like that. That's just my nature. And the people who seem to enjoy that are practicing safe sex, as it is. So everyone's just being a lot more cautious.
So there is a real awareness.
Oh, yeah, there is an
I
awareness.
read these statistics saying that people are just not
I know.
paying attention.
Well, the people I know are fairly responsible people. And they know that there's a chance that he can die. And it's not worth dying over, to be honest with you.
What about availability of birth control for women and for men on campus? Men with the AIDS epidemic, prophylactics, were they readily available?
Which I think is a good idea. I think it's a very good
Were they
idea.
available in the dorms, or did you guys have to go out to the range and
I if I
walk?
recall correctly, the year after I moved out, there was a controversy about putting condom machines in the dorm bathrooms. I don't know if that ever went through. I mean, That's just something that I can recall. It really wasn't any concern.
Did you get any counseling or workshops or anything like that, in the dorms or whatnot, that dealt with these?
They were offered. I didn't go to any of them myself.
So they weren't required?
No.
Was there anything like that required in the dorms?
No.
Orientations of any kind that dealt with specific topics?
I think when women enroll here, they are required to attend a seminar on sexual assault and harassment, which is another good idea.
Now, as a staff member, this is Barry Tucker. We're continuing my interview with V. Kyle Bender on March 7th. As a staff member, every spring I get a note about suicides, warning about students, possibility of student suicides at the beginning of the level of school. Was that an issue at all with the people? I mean, here you are on the 10th floor of Woody Hall, for example.
It's always something very far in the back of your mind. And if someone's really, really down, that he or she might try suicide. But it never really was a major concern. There's always one or two people a year that do kill themselves, it seems, in the dorms. And that really kind of shakes everybody up. Because you think, wow, that, you know, someone your age, apparently your intelligence, things like that, kind of rattles your cage a little bit, that someone like that would kill themselves.
Did that happen in your dorm at all, or anywhere during your dorm?
I don't recall. I think someone on the Lakeshore dorms killed herself. That's all I can remember.
What about the Dean of Students? Dean Rouse or whoever it was, Ginsburg?
Ginsburg when I got here.
Did you have any contact with him at all in terms of dorms? Did he ever come around here?
I met him once when he was, I don't know if he was just loitering or touring Witty. I just met him once. That was about it. I never really had much concern for that.
Were you in any kind of clubs or organizations or fraternities or anything like that?
No. My sophomore year, I was very busy. I mean, just first getting my feet underneath me, like I said, and then trying to get back into the groove, because this place really knocks you off center for a while. And then my junior year, I had to go get a job, and that takes up a lot of time, too.
We're going to turn to an area now that I think you'll have some comments on, and that's athletics.
Oh, great.
We have seen some interesting things in our last four years here at UW, or the last 3 years in your case.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to comment on some, since you're obviously more knowledgeable than most people, being a reporter for the Herald.
And that's what I do want to go into is sports broadcasting.
Sports, right. You are going to be a sports broadcaster.
Probably won't get that at first, but as I go higher up the television ladder, I hope it gets more specialized, and then I can really follow what I want to do.
Which is sports.
Yes. So I've always been a fan. That's how I first got into broadcasting. I was a four-year-old football player.
Let's talk about some of the different sports and the coaches and the personalities involved, because historical purposes, we can get some nice comparisons from here. What about the basketball team with Coach Yoder?
If you would have asked me that question a year ago when they were 18 and 12 and went to the NIT, I'd say the man's doing just a hell of a job. He's the best man for the job. Couldn't have another one. No, I don't know. I don't know if he can quite know how to use the personnel he has. We'll see next year when he loses Danny Jones, the all-time leading scorer. And that's going to be a tremendous loss. And like the article in the Cardinal said yesterday about Jones leaving, that not one player that the Badgers have can fill his shoes. Agreed, but they have a lot of talented younger players that can fill it as a group. And I don't know about his style of play. It seems sort of constricting.
Do you think they might have relied on him too much this year, and that might be part of the problem?
In a sense, yes. I think that relying so much on Danny Jones really hindered the development this year of the other players, like Larry Heisel Jr., who was a guard, finally starting to play well, and it's the end of the season. I mean, he's really come on, and if he was expected to carry some of the burden earlier in the season, you know, who knows how he'd do now. And Yoder doesn't know Seemingly, I'm just, this is all opinion. These are all opinions and not those of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin. These are just my opinions. That little disclaimer. That doesn't really seem to know what to do. At one game, someone will play 25 minutes and do a great job. Next game, they'll play 5. There really doesn't seem to be any continuity. Not only did Wisconsin know that they had to rely on Danny Jones, so did all 5 of the players on the other team. So they'd always try to hammer it into Danny Jones. And I think that cost them a few games. The Indiana game this past Saturday, for example. They're up by 13 points with about 5 minutes to go. Danny Jones is on the bench with foul trouble, and they rally and take this big lead, and they put him back in, and they lose by 2 points. Just, I don't know. Yoder never really could beat Indiana.
Yeah, that's always been a problem. What about hockey?
They're loaded. And this year in and year out, I think it's the most enjoyable program because they win. They win, and Jeff Sauer, the coach, can get people here that can play well and win. This year, I just prayed that I'd see a national champion before I left. I've left school. I haven't left town yet. And I think this team is talented enough to do it. Whether or not they can win the big game is subject to some debate yet because, well, they haven't really proved themselves. Sure, Jeff Sauer won a national title in 83, but that was essentially Bob Johnson's team that he took over. That team was just loaded with talent. Like Chris Chelios played for the Canadiens. Pat Flatley plays for the Islanders. Who else is that? Bruce Driver. I think Mike Richter might. No, no. Yeah, Mike Richter. I think was on that team. He's playing for the Rangers. They're just a tremendously talented team that was led by juniors and seniors that pretty much knew how to do the job by itself. But that's exciting.
So this is truly Sauer's team now?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Did you attend many of the hockey and basketball games?
Not as many as I would have liked to.
Hockey
is a very hard ticket. And for one, I was towards the end of my career in the last 2 years, I was academic career. I was working, so I didn't really have that much time to go to hockey games or things like that. But when I did, it's just such a good time. The fans get really involved, especially the students. When they're talking about building a new arena, and oh, they'd never fill it, they keep saying. If they just sell more student tickets, I think they'd have no problem filling it. It's a fun place to be, the Civ chant and the band. I'll miss hockey games when I move out of here, I'll tell you, Barry.
What about the sport that's probably seen the toughest go of it in the last 4 or 5 years here at UW, ever since Coach McClain died in
1986.
Shell, wasn't it? When he died?
I think it was in the Shell.
Or it was Camp Randall, something like that.
Or, yeah.
Anyway, they've briefly hired his assistant, Coach Hillis, and dismissed him after a year. He was interim coach.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hired Don Morton for, 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
And he was recently dismissed, and Barry Alvarez was hired on New Year's Day of 1990, kind of starting the new decade off on a different foot. Do you want to comment on what you've seen here?
I've always been a Wisconsin fan ever since I was a small child because my father was, and you know how sons tend to follow around their dads, and so I've always been a fan. I remember the first football game I went to, I think I was 5. And, of course, they lost. And that seems to be the general trend. After McClain came in, though, that it seemed like this could be a competitive program year in and year out. And his dying just really kicked out the jams for just a terrible slide. And Don Morton's tenure really greased the skids for that slide. Just went from a good program that's right now just about hit bottom and now starting to come back up. It's going to take a few years, but I think it'll be back.
What did Morton do wrong?
He tried to install the wrong offense. I had my doubts when he came in with this Veer offense of his. I didn't think it would work. I don't think a finesse offense works in the Big Ten. Otherwise, Northwestern would go to the Rose Bowl every year, and they don't. It's big teams like Michigan and Ohio State, and Michigan State when they had Tony Mandrich. Just big teams that will go out and beat you. literally beat you physically. And he tried to install the Veer offense and with a bunch of players that McLean recruited to run his pro set offense, and that was just doomed. I think maybe Morton had maybe just a little bit too much of a either self-confidence or an ego to think that he could put in this brand new offense with players that have never played it and make it work. He didn't really seem to try to adapt it to the players he had. He had some big players and some quarterbacks who could pass, like Bud Keys, who, despite really not playing in 87, got drafted. I mean, he had some talent. And by the time...
Well, I think he was a sixth college quarterback drafted that year or something.
Was he?
Something pretty high, yeah. I mean, it must have been sixth. It must have been lower than that. But still,
yeah.
Relatively speaking, fairly high for a guy who hadn't played in the last year.
That just shows that Morton really didn't adapt himself to the talent. He tried to force things on the players he had.
Do you know anything about, like, from our team morale, things like that?
The team basically stood behind its coach. But I know some of the players weren't happy because some of them felt that they were not being used properly. And they were losing. I mean, they won two games this year, and so that's they won six games in Morton's 3 years here, and he went 6-27. They got tired of just being beaten every week. I can't. How many Big Ten games did they win? Four or something like that.
Oh, and Gary Moeller recently appointed head coach of Michigan. When he left Michigan for 3 years to be a head coach at Illinois, his cumulative record was identical to Morton's over a three-year period. And he was fired, and he went back to Michigan, where he is now head coach of the team that probably had the best recruiting year of any team in college football, except Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Do you think it's just a part of... Do you think it's just... If Morton had been given more time, maybe, he might have been able to prove himself, or do you think he would have just compounded the disaster?
I think, in retrospect, it probably would not... Probably would have improved. I don't see how it could have gotten much worse, but I don't think it would have gotten all that much better. He really couldn't recruit. He made the mistake of coming in and, well, this is all my conjecture, of severing the ties with the high school coaches in the state that McLean worked so hard to build. And he fired Jerry Fishbane, who was Morton's recruiting coordinator, I think. And yeah, I think... McLean's recruiting coordinator. And that... bothered a lot of the coaches who had a rapport with Fishbane. And that alienated them right off the bat. And it's been in many published reports that a lot of state high school coaches will steer their kids away from Wisconsin. If they think they have talent enough to play in the Big Ten, they'll say, go to Iowa or go to Michigan, go to Michigan State. Don't go to Wisconsin. And now with Alvarez coming in, I think that attitude is changing. Alvarez is trying very hard to reestablish those ties with the high school coaches.
Do you think Alvarez will be successful?
Well, he hasn't lost yet. The buzz is good around Alvarez right now. He has a very forgiving schedule next year, and funny as it may sound, I hope he doesn't do too well and win six or seven games and get everyone's expectations too high. Because it's going to take some time. He did a fairly good job recruiting, and considering he had about a month and a half.
How does his class compare to Morton's classes?
Well, he's got most of the good Wisconsin players, just something rare, which makes it a lot better than Morton's classes. Okay. It's so hard to say right now because he hasn't coached it down yet.
Mm-hmm. But from at least your current standpoint,
the current standpoint is very bright. He came in with a lot of positive energy.
Well, the good thing, of course, about talking about things like this, Kyle, is people listen to this 25 years from now, they're going to know the answers. They're going to be able to say, boy, oh boy, he doesn't know what he's talking.
Listen to him talk. What an idiot.
Now, you did some covering both in Peoria and for the Herald, initially at least, on women's athletics. Mm-hmm. Can you make some comments on the women's sports situation here at UW?
I think it's a very underrated aspect of the athletic program. Everyone looks at the football team, the basketball team, and the hockey team. And what they miss is people like Susie Faber, who's just a tremendously talented runner. And they missed the women's soccer team in 1988 that went to the Final Four. And they miss the crew team year in and year out, tremendously successful. I mean, here on campus, we know all about these things. But if you go to Milwaukee, no one cares. And I think that's too bad. And the women's basketball team is setting attendance records right now here in 1990, and they're drawing 1,100 people, which I think is too bad. I think it's a good operation that's underrated by the people.
I was just going to ask you, what about student support for all the athletic programs here at UW?
Well, I remember, I think it revolves around not so much winning, although that helps a lot, and we'll find out about that later, but how much fun you can have at a game. Right now, the basketball team is moderately successful, and not only that, but they have the bleacher creatures that just go there and just have a good time, make noise, and harass the other team, which is college basketball, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I remember when I got here, football games on Saturdays were events that you got up in the morning to go to. Of course, you had to drink before the game, so that was expected of you at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I mean, I don't know how many times get in late from a Friday night's debauchery and someone comes up to your door at 8 o'clock and, get out of bed, got to start drinking for the football game. Oh, that's right, I forgot. Walk out the door and someone hands you a beer. Go take a shower. There's donuts in the den. Oh, great. Donuts.
So you have a Pabst in one hand and you have a Dunkin' Donut?
Dunkin' Donut in the other. I was young then. I could handle it. But it was more of an event. Then they started cracking down in 87 and took all the fun out of it. Body passing was outlawed. Couldn't throw cups. I mean, these are all things that could be harmful. But if you knew what you were doing at a football game, it was just a good time.
So do you think that kind of crackdown, along with the boring offense created by Mormon, really...
Yeah, that and the fact that they got drilled every Saturday, or so it seemed.
Well, I used to go to the McLean games early in his tenure, and they were 3-9 for the season. They had 75,000 people.
Mm-hmm. That's because it was an entertaining offense.
People had fun.
Yeah. But now, then they got the Gestapo in to run stadium security. They frisked students. I've been frisked going into football games, into the student section. Then there are games when I go with my family into the double deck side, and the alumni section is walk right in, flasks everywhere. It's amazing the double standard that went on there.
And the students didn't.
Students didn't appreciate that because word gets around. And another thing is when they. Had alcohol in the boxes in the press building. And we couldn't drink in the stadium. And here are these wealthy, high-powered alumni, which I hope to be one of these days, up drinking their scotch and soda up in the boxes outside of the, you know, inside, you know, away from the rain and the cold.
So how are you going to feel in 20 years when the students make you stop drinking?
I'll just drink before the game like I always do. Well, hopefully I'll be here to work the games and not to party.
So that would be the ultimate for you, would be to
come back here,
come back here.
Take my color guy around. No, I went to that bar, and that's where I used to live. I love this town.
Talk about Madison a little bit, the town.
Madison has everything. It may be kind of hard to find for someone's particular interest, but if you're interested in something, no matter how esoteric it is, you can probably find it, and you can probably do it. It's such a diverse community, and that's one thing I'm also going to miss as I leave town and start on the career track. It's just all different types of people. One thing I did notice is that I think there were more black students at Bradley than there are here in Madison, because Bradley made an active effort to recruit talented black students from the Chicago area and from Peoria, I think, too. And it's just some people of a different race that you can hang out with. And I think that's great. Mm-hmm. And now there are troubles here with minority recruitment and enrollment. And I think it's almost a self-perpetuating problem.
Do you think Madison is a racist town?
Racist?
Yeah. Or prejudiced?
Discriminatory?
We've heard those words used a lot in the press in the last year or so.
I don't know if it's necessarily racist. Racist is a very strong term. There are racist people, as we see by the continuing incidents that seem to come up every so often. I think there are people that are, I think there are all kinds of people here. I think people that are very open-minded, and then there are people that are just basically rednecks.
Why not more blacks here? Why aren't there more blacks here?
They can't get more blacks here because blacks don't come here, and if they blacks don't come here, they can't get more blacks to come here.
So
it's a catch 22. Yeah. It is a predominantly white campus, and that's kind of disturbing. It seems to be gradually, almost at a glacial pace, coming more homogeneous, you know, wealthy white suburban kids coming here for their higher education. Just as I've been here, it seems like there are a lot less different sorts of people.
What about out-of-staters? You said that there's this, back in the dorms, you had this floor of northern Wisconsiners, and you see that with a certain amount of condescension in your voice.
I didn't mean that. I love them.
No, I mean, you were
They were just young, young and silly. What?
What about out-of-state students, Illinois students, New York students, things like that? Is there any...
I could make some sweeping generalizations. It seems like the Illinois students that come here are from wealthy families and are just interested in, you know, graduating in some good discipline and getting a high-paying job. It seems like the New York students are also from wealthy families, but they seem to be more concerned with what's going on around them. And I think that seems to be almost a pattern here. I mean, wasn't Paul Soglin from New Jersey or something like that, from Virginia?
Actually, I think he's from Illinois.
Is he? Well, tan my hide.
I'm not sure.
They come here and they seem to be more liberal, especially now. I think Wisconsin students are more middle of the road and more concerned with getting a job. And the Eastern students are more concerned with the issues of the day. I used to be a lot more socially aware than I am, but I need to get a job. I need to make some money. So anyone out there hiring a hardworking young stud reporter like myself? I'll take the job.
You talked a little bit about the attitude toward blacks. What about the attitude toward Jews? Are you aware of any anti-Semitism on campus?
Every so often I'll see a swastika painted on some building, which just, that really boils my blood. And I really don't see much sense in anti-Semitism. I don't see much sense in racism. And just people are people. So, I didn't, you know, being from the north side, the far north side of Milwaukee, I mean, the far north side, out in practically in the self-contained suburb, but there weren't that many Jews there. I mean, I met Jewish people in college, and it's like, when you're from Milwaukee, when there is a sizable Jewish community, but it's nothing like actually living with them and seeing that they're people. That's a beautiful thing about college. They live on the same floor with, you know, some blacks and some Jews and some Orientals, and they're all people. People are people. People hating each other just because of religion or race is completely stupid.
One other area that's been a lot of press lately has been the women's issue, I guess is one way of calling it, with the concern about rape and the rape crisis and things like that. Do you think that that's affected women in any way in their attitudes toward men on campus?
I don't think it could help but affect them. I think they have to be very cautious, and they can't walk alone at night. And if they are, which they shouldn't, then they have to be very suspicious, and they have to be ready to ward off an attacker. That's another thing that really makes me angry, too. But it's something that they have to be aware of, and sadly enough, there are people out there who do assault women. I've walked almost all of my female friends, you know, somewhere or other, just so that someone is with him, which is something I gladly do. It's a shame, though, it really is.
Let's see, hold on a second.
Anything you can think of?
I was just informed that we have an area that I wasn't aware of, and that's interning.
Mm-hmm.
Where and when did you intern, and what was it like?
Well, for television, I interned out at Channel 15, which will probably be here for some time to come. What did I do?
Yeah.
At first, I was a peon. I just taped Packer games, and that was it, and I left. Then I went away for a little bit, came back and worked under a different sports anchor, and I got a lot more responsibility and did a lot of editing, a lot of writing, preparing things for broadcast, you know, actual things that actually went on the air, which is a responsibility.
Who did you work for?
At first I worked for, well, I'd rather not talk about the first one, Mike Heller. I worked on Sundays, which was football, a lot of football. First Sunday he was out there, he didn't know me that well, I didn't know him that well. He said, can you write for broadcast? And I said, damn straight I can write for broadcast. He said, here, take this. Go make a practice voiceover tape, write the script, bring it up, and I'll see how it is. And I went down, edited it, and typed up the script, handed it to him. He said, that's really good, we're going to use it. That's, ever since then, he let me do a lot of things. That basically, it's a lot of just helping to alleviate the workload of the anchor. It's not a glamorous job, it doesn't pay, but it's experience, and you have to have experience to get anywhere. So I learned a lot about working under pressure, which I seem to thrive on. I love the adrenaline rush. It's great. Yeah. And there was one time when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's last game at Milwaukee. And so anyway, it's his last game. And so I taped the game off the microwave feed and had it ready to go at about 10 after 10. Then Jay Humphries made a basket at the last second, about quarter after 10, to win the game. There's hysteria and all that. And Mike says, I want that last shot. You're going to have to do the last half over. Okay. So I grabbed the tape, and it was like broadcast news. And that scene where, whatever her name is, that actress is running through the hallway with the tape, you know, furiously dodging obstacles to try to get it to the console on time for broadcast. I had to run downstairs, re-edit everything in about 2 minutes, got it done, sprinted into the tape room, handed it to the technician who put it into the tape machine as he was talking about the game, and we go to Milwaukee, and there it was, dodging, you know, spare camera parts lying in the hallway and kicking open doors. I got a tape coming, hurry up. Getting phone calls during commercials. How's it going? It's good, almost done. Got about 10 more seconds. Okay, good. That's what I like about it. I like the rush. I like the deadline. I think I can handle it. I know I can handle it. That's one thing I remember.
I think I've talked about everything that I want to talk about.
Well, there's got to be something more here.
Well,
we have all this taped.
Okay, we're going to talk about a few different things here. We have two student newspapers here at the university. Kyle's talked about one, the Badger Herald.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the Daily Cardinal for a little bit. Do you have any reason to meet with those people? Or?
I know people who wrote and have written for the Cardinal. They just seem like normal people. They don't seem at all. Well, that's just, I'm a liberal to moderate sort of person. And the perception of the Cardinal is these radical left-wingers, which sometimes it seems that they try to intentionally cultivate that image. But they're just plain folks. But I remember a friend of mine from high school wrote for the Cardinal, and at the time was a flaming communist, and we'd get into these heated verbal exchanges. Not necessarily an argument, but he'd try to convince me that communism and capitalism were not self-exclusive. And we'd, oh, yeah, sure. And then there from there on it was, well, how can you say this? How can you say that? Back and forth. I don't know about the Cardinal. Sometimes I think they try too hard to be ultra-liberal hipsters.
How do the people at the Herald generally regard the people at the Cardinal?
Respect and loathing. It'd be a title of a nice.
Loathing in terms of their left-wing leanings or their poor journalism or what?
The Cardinal historically has some pretty solid writers. They make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. You can't really fault them for their journalism. I think it's more their left-wing hysteria more than anything that draws the ire of the Herald, which, of course, used to be right-wing hysteria. And they were just on completely opposite sides of practically everything. That has a lot to do with the Herald's editorial board, which, if I think during my tenure there, was controlled by people who weren't students. People had graduated in 1974 and things like that. And here was 1988, and the head editorial writer was like 35 years old or something like that. That didn't make any sense. It's supposed to be a student newspaper, and its editorial policies are being set by this 35-year-old in Chicago. I mean, I don't know if that's entirely necessarily true. I wasn't really tight with the editorial people, but that was the perception.
Any idea of what the Cardinals' perception was of the Herald?
Sort of same, not so much respect, but same amount of loathing. I always get the feeling that they don't respect the Herald as much as the Herald respected the Cardinal. Now with the Cardinals' recent financial difficulties here at the turn of the new decade, I think it's getting a little more heated between the papers again.
Why?
The Herald is always maintaining that the Cardinals run up this huge debt with the university, which the university has now in effect forgiven half of.
Mm-hmm.
And the Herald has always maintained that it's self-sufficient and self-supporting and things of that sort. And so that's where the Herald gets a little bit irked.
What about students in general, the students you've had contact with? How do they view the papers, the two papers?
Something to read during class?
Do they think about them politically much, in terms of their politics much?
Yeah. Especially if some or other of the paper comes up with a really ludicrous stance on some issue that's going to just offend a lot of people. And then of course, it's the utmost concern for that while. But usually it's just something to read in class. You know, it's where the crossword puzzle is.
We had a rather large controversy this year, student government. Could you characterize that? That one was Michelle Goodwin.
And Megan Hansen?
Yeah.
I think they just tried to be more important than they really were. I think Michelle Goodwin went to Korea, North Korea. This is North Korea, a pretty nasty country, in my opinion, on WSA funds, which I don't think is completely legal. And she was there ostensibly to attend this peace conference. I mean, a North Korean peace conference is an oxymoron. But she went there, and it cost about $7,000, and I guess they didn't go through the proper channels. Some of the people that aren't in her party raised a squawk and called for her impeachment or resignation. Nothing has really changed. Nothing ever changes. WSA doesn't realize that it has no power. Not anymore. They've frittered it away. And they talk about lobbying for a lower drinking age and to keep tuition capped. They haven't done anything since I've been here. And so someone like Steve Marmel comes in with his joke party. So what? Who cares? They're not going to get anything done anyway.
So it means a lot of fun, do I know?
Essentially, ever since the Pail and Shovel party, which is pretty, it's notorious and almost nostalgic. People look back at the Statue of Liberty in Lake Mendota and the Pink Flamingos over on Bascom Hill and, oh boy, those were the days, huh? Nothing got done, but everyone had a good time. That's when the credibility really started to slide, though. I don't think it's ever really recovered. I think that instead of spending $7,000 to go to some peace conference in North Korea, they could spend the money on lobbying the capital to lower the drinking age. I mean, there's a certain... I don't understand that, and I don't understand wanting to set up a sister university agreement with that Palestinian college. What does it have to do with us? I mean, it's great to broaden our horizons and to foster mutual world understanding, but... tuition keeps going up. Pretty soon, the only people that will come here will be the wealthy white suburban kids.
How much power did, getting back to the particular thing of going to North Korea, was that pretty much Michelle Goodwin's own initiative?
I think so.
She just signed off on it?
Yeah.
Sent herself?
I believe so. I'm almost positive that there was some discussion.
It's sort of difficult for me to imagine that the president of a student organization student government, any organization, would mm-hmm. sign off on a $7,000. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure the various tactics she used to finance the trip, but I guess they're all legal in her eyes, and so off she went. $7,100. That's a lot of money. I don't understand a student peace conference. If they can't get their own house in order in Madison, what's the point of going to North Korea? Doesn't make much sense.
What about the student lobby for Germany? You talked about that. Is that a popular issue among students?
It comes and goes. I'd like to see the drinking age lowered because it really didn't make much sense to raise it in the first place. But essentially, if you want to drink here, there is no problem. So that's why not everyone's so bent out of shape about it. It's like, oh, drinking age hasn't gone up. Can't get into the bars. I'll just go to house parties.
Well, while we're on the subject of bars, once again,
seem to have quite a bit of knowledge about, yeah.
What are some of the major bars that you go to? Would you characterize them? What kind of places they are?
Well, when I was in Witty, I went to the Nitty Gritty. I'm a poet and didn't even know it, which is right across Francis Street from the Witty Hall. And the year before I got there, it was a real dive. There were no windows and looked like a cave. Then I get up here and it's this, you know, woodwork dominated green restaurant bar. It's a very nice place. And basically everyone goes, you know, all sorts of people can go there. Well, where else did I go? Then there's the Rathskeller, which is the true cross-section of the campus. Everybody goes to the Union. It's such a great place. And I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss sitting out on the terrace looking over the lake.
Yeah, the terrace is to me sort of the university, the place where so much happens.
Yeah, I really enjoy the terrace. I can't wait till it warms up so I can go sit
on
the terrace.
What about Carroll Street? Where did you go? What bars, downtown bars did you go?
Well, the same. I've always lived close to downtown, I've always gone to the same places.
Which are?
On Nitty Gritty. The Union. I mean, you get used to walking here. I've had friends come in from my Bradley friends come up and visit me when I lived on Carroll Street, and we walked from Carroll Street to the Union over to Mifflin Street to a party, which to the typical medicine student, well, that's nothing. That's just a pebble in the pond, and they were just worn out. I can't believe you walk this much, and every day. Walking is expected. Bradley's campus is maybe 3-4 city blocks. It was 5 minutes from the door of my dorm room to my desk in the hall. 5 minutes. Now if I bike, maybe I can make it in 10 or 15. It's just a much bigger campus. Just the usual slew of State Street bars, getting back to that. The old Brat House, that was a cool place. I didn't really like the fraternity-dominated places like the College Club or the Flamingo, although a friend of mine worked at the Flamingo, so I go there to see her every so often. I like the Plaza, which probably will still be here in 75 years, because that place has been here since, I believe, 1943. And if all goes well, it will still be here. It's another one of those places where anybody can go to. And you see everything from skinheads to death chicks to just...
Okay, what's a death chick?
A death chick is... You know, or death dude, they wear white makeup, you know, black mascara on their eyebrows and eyelashes. They wear black leather, you know, all black, and they look dead. Sometimes even black makeup. Deaf people. I don't necessarily agree with their fashion and philosophy choices, but you know, it's nice to know that they're there, I suppose. I'd have to say the Plaza. At this stage of my life, I'm looking forward. No, I will be leaving. I'm not looking forward to leaving Madison, but I'll have to. So now, and so I've been reminiscing a little bit, thinking back about the places that I'll miss. I'll definitely miss the Union and the Plaza. And the Irish Pub, which is a great place to just go sit and talk. And it's a small bar, but I've never had a dull conversation at the Irish Pub. Something about it. And, you know, the usual slew of places like the Regent Street Retreat, which is more of a upperclassman bar. But just to show that sometimes people never change, it's just as obnoxious as going to a house party dominated by freshmen.
Is there a eatery in town that sort of characterizes Madison to you, student days here?
Eatery?
Well, you mentioned the Plaza, of course. Already.
The Plaza. I've eaten at the Gritty. Gosh, that's a good question. Gordon Commons. There's one place I ate most at, it was Gordon Commons. Or Pops Club.
Where?
Dorm food. Pops Club?
I don't
even know the weak cousin of Gordo's. When Gordo's would close and they'd only serve meals, Pops would always be open from 7 to 11 every day. You could always get a cheeseburger or something if you wanted to. Actually, one of the best known hangover remedies is either a University Hall cheeseburger at Bradley or a Pops Club cheeseburger here at Gordo's. Something about the grease content of these cheeseburgers just knocks out whatever ails you. Well, you wanted the typical state of the student.
I'm going to change the subject dramatically now to religion. When you lived at home, did you go to church much?
Only because I had to and was expected of me. I'm not a very religious person.
How did that change when you came to college?
No one was there to wake me up at 9 o'clock every Sunday morning and go to mass. So I just slept until 11. No skin off my nose. I believe in God and things of that nature. I'm Catholic, and it can be a very depressing religion. And I don't want to be depressed at this point in my life. And my parents are somewhat upset that I don't go to church right now, but they seem to be reassured with the knowledge that I'll go back. And maybe I will. I don't know. Just not right now. I'm having too much fun on Saturday nights to get up on Sunday mornings to go to church.
Is your experience, you think, pretty much typical of the student here in Madison?
Yeah, pretty much.
Not many that go to church?
No. In fact, those that do are considered somewhat unusual. You got up at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning to go to church? Yes. Wow, you weird. It's just religion isn't very important. Students are under a certain amount of pressure. And if they couldn't go and enjoy themselves, they'd probably just burst. So one way of doing it for a lot of people is going on a Saturday night and drinking. Of course, you don't want to get up too early the next day because Sundays are a day to study before your Monday classes, so you sleep in. That happened to me quite a bit. Go out on Saturday, get in late, get up late, go
What's
get
late?
Some... Late, I get in around 2 or 3 and get up around 11 or 12. Sunday mornings, which is, to me, lend themselves well to sleeping in. And get up and go get something to eat. Maybe watch football with the guys in the den. Talk about manly things. And then study. That was about it. It's a very easy life. And I hope if the students ever hear this, they realize how easy it is.
What about jobs? Part-time jobs in school. What were your jobs?
Well, I worked here for the Oral History Project for about almost 2 years. And I liked it a lot because of my liking for history, of course. And I seemed to do a pretty good job, I think.
How did you get that
job? I saw a flyer on campus that Laura Smale had put up. And I came in and said I'd like to apply for the job, and she interviewed me right there, and the next day she called and said, can you start on Tuesday? Sure. And there it was. That was basically it. And I worked at over in the archives in the basement of the library with some really great people. And I liked that job too. And where else did I work? I worked in this building in the Red Gym for the recreational sports department, essentially handing out towels and keeping track of the building. There are some things I had to do that were important, but it didn't take very long. It was a good place to come and study. No. Sometimes I even look forward to coming to work here. Just sit here. You can just be sometimes. Sit there and nothing will happen. You can virtually meditate. Someone will come in. Could I have a towel, please? Yes, you hand them their towel, and you go back. to your own little world. But there, I wouldn't do that very often because I'd feel bad. I felt like I should be working, getting something accomplished, or studying. It's a job that lends itself very well to studying. You can do a lot. Anything you can sit down and do at a desk, you can do it at the armory. Where else did I work?
What about word processors? Did you use those in your own personal?
I don't own one. Some roommates of mine have owned one, and I have used them, and I think they're a great help. And in years from now, everyone will probably have one, and they won't realize how much of a chore it was to sit down and type something.
So you use the typewriter?
Yeah, more than a word processor.
Were you pretty typical for students to do?
Yes. More students had much better typewriters than I had. I had this beat-up old electronic typewriter. But not as many had word processors. The university provides them, but that's usually pretty crowded. And one of my roommates had one, so I just said, go use his.
What about, what's your opinion, just sort of gut reaction to the chancellor? Donna Shoyle has been in the office now for 2.5 years.
I think she's doing a good job. And there's always seems to be, every time she does something, though, there always seems to be some lurking ulterior motive beyond the one that she states for whatever decree or action she has given or taken. And I just don't know. There's something about, I think she's doing a heck of a job. I mean, I can't say that she's turned around this campus because it didn't have to be turned around in the first place. But there are some things that she should tend to, especially the minority issue, that just seem to keep going on and on and on and not really get resolved. That's just keeping in the UW tradition of forming committees. There's a problem, form a committee to study it for a year until the problem goes away. I wish someone would just stand up and say, here's a problem, this is what we're going to do about it, and do something about it. And there was this whole minority thing and got started. And there was the Holly Report, which had very set recommendations about what should be done, and which seemed to be the proper thing, and she overturned that with the Madison Plan, which seems to be stalling. But on the whole, she's taken charge of the athletic department situation, which was bad. She seems to be doing a pretty good job.
I think we're
and we're all out of time.
2 seconds or so. Any final comment on the state of the world?